It was the dawn of the third age of podcasting, 12 years after the B5 premiere. The Babylon podcast was a dream given form, its goal to discuss Babylon 5 episodes, arcs, and implications, to interview the cast and crew about their experiences and memories. It's a home away from home for fanboys, geek girls, and lurkers. It can be a silly place, but it's our last best hope for B5 fans. This is the podcast about the story of the last of the Babylon stations. The year is 2006. The name of the show is the Babylon Podcast.
And welcome back to another Babylon Podcast. I am Summer Brooks.
I'm Tim Callender.
Hey there, it's Jeffrey Willis, and you ready for this? This is the sound of me eating a Dodger dog at Dodger Stadium in Los Angeles. A new first for the Babylon Podcast. More culinary genius.
Dodger dogs. Garibaldi and Sheridan would be jealous.
Exactly my point.
Do you think they had Dodger dogs on the station, or the equivalent thereof?
I'd say no, because that's a localized delicacy. Very hard to import, just like eggs.
Well, I'm thinking that it'll be copied forevermore. Probably wouldn't taste the same as the original, but certainly has the potential of going down in history as being one of the great culinary... Excuse me, I'm just about to choke on this. Let me drink some more beer here, because that always helps my digestion and the quality of these shows, yeah.
As versatile a foodstuff as Spoo is, you could probably create a facsimile of at least a B5 wiener or something that they could serve up at a game.
I just can't really figure out which race it would have been that might have done that.
Now, it's interesting. You know, with you, Jeffrey, there enjoying a Dodger dog at Dodger Stadium, I think you bring together two elements that have made themselves felt the Babylon 5 universe. One is food, and the other is baseball. And it's kind of interesting that, you know, baseball did play a small role in the show. There was the one episode where Franklin is making a bet with one of the pilots about who's going to win the World Series.
Mm-hmm.
And now the exact episode escapes me. I want to say it was...
I'm at a loss. But
yeah, I almost want to say it was All Alone in the Night, maybe. Anyways, the Star Fury pilot comes back half dead, and Franklin, in the course of trying to save his life as a way to kind of keep him motivated, tells him, "Don't you die on me. I've got to collect my bet."
Yeah.
You know, and it wasn't that he was trying to be cold-hearted. It was, you know, Franklin was looking for everything he could to keep the guy alive.
Yeah.
You might be right,
because... He didn't make it back, and Sheridan was kind of upset to find out that he didn't.
Right, right. And then, of course, there's the episode Knives, where we are treated to Garibaldi and Sheridan taking batting practice at a field in the station.
Mm-hmm.
And at least they had the good sense of maybe not replacing umpires for real games. I have a little note about that. But anyways, that they had a computer... sensor combination determining whether or not the balls were foul or fair.
Mm-hmm.
What a step forward that would be.
Yeah. And we had numerous instances where you see Garibaldi flipping through the paper and he goes, lousy Dodgers.
Now, I have my own little JMS anecdote here, and it is involving with baseball, and I'm sure the grade maker has no clue it was me, but there's the scene in, if I believe, There Are All the Honor Lies, at the beginning where Sheridan and DeLenn are both getting copies of Universe Today. And Sheridan says to DeLenn, "I just wanted to see who won the sixth game of the World Series." Now, as we all know, the great maker was paying a great deal of attention to all the various postings and questions online of Genie and Usenet and all that. He got a lot of questions about that episode. What was going on? What were the Minbari up to? So forth, so on. Well, I posted up the question, who won the sixth game of the 59 series? He responded And here's the response. I went searching for it. And this is what impressed me. I'll give you the answer in a minute, but this is when I knew the man was completely out of his skull. He didn't just say it was the Dodgers. He wrote, Mars won the sixth game, but it was a squeaker 5-4. That tied it up going into the seventh game, which Earth won on an RBI that Mars is still challenging on the belief that the guy was really out at home, but that the umpire was catering to pressure.
No way. Awesome.
Even the baseball games get tied into the great arc that went on in that show.
Oh, man. That's
that
beautiful.
That's pretty terrific. That's pretty terrific. I have to say that I thought, you know, that perhaps, you know, the scene we were talking about in Knives with Garibaldi and Sheridan in the virtual baseball stadium where they were doing some batting practice there, that unless Jerry and Bruce have attended a ball game together, which certainly they may have, they do a lot of things like that, but it's possible that this podcast could be the closest anyone has come since that moment when we filmed that, you know, doing the podcast directly from the stadium. I'm down at field level right behind home plate right now, so it certainly has that same perspective that we created, that was created in that sequence. And I also just flashed on, I remember, I just what a large green screen environment we had set up. I seem to recall that set was very, very green screen. So next time we have one of our VizFX gurus on the show, let's remember to ask them if that was perhaps the largest green screen setup that we had ever done for a Babylon 5 show, you know, for an episode.
Okay, taking notes.
Exactly.
Note to self. I just had to walk away from my seat because there's some screaming kids behind me, which I'm sure will just make this game really enjoyable for me.
Well, I have one last note here, a little bit of news before we go on to the next part of our podcast. And this is regarding the upcoming direct-to-DVD New Babylon 5 stories. This also comes off the JMS News Usenet feed. Somebody had posted up something they had read regarding what the content of the first DVD will be. Seems to be it was going to be about three episodes about three different characters. And then JMS elaborates on that in response, and he says that it's going to be about 1.5 hour per story, so figure about 75 to 90 minutes per DVD, plus additional material adding up to a 2-hour DVD. So I think what's interesting more than anything from where I'm sitting is that you're looking at three episodes, three different characters, each episode roughly about 30 minutes, which of course is half the length of the standard Babylon 5 episode.
More than half, because after you take out commercials, the episodes are 42 minutes.
Right, I guess that's true. I'd forgotten that. Yeah. You're right.
That's interesting.
So should we do like a football pool kind of thing? Should we have like, you know, everybody send us a dollar and we'll create a thing that to try to figure out who the three characters are actually going to be, and when that's announced, they win something? I mean, just saying, you know.
Just a thought. Just a thought.
We could just ask everybody to send us a dollar and forget the pool. But
I wonder if we could take a fan poll and say, you know, who the fans hope is in... Who the fans want to see first? Who's like, who are the first three characters whose stories you want to see? I mean, I'm sure JMS already has the order of the stories he wants in a specific order, but he's listened to fans before.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, he does. Well, given that Bruce Boxleitner apparently is always willing to talk about the show, as you say, Jeffrey, I would wager that we're looking at a Sheridan story first up.
You know, I would, if I was a betting man, I would say that that has possibilities. That has strong possibilities. I would think that under the right conditions and business arrangement, that Bruce would be very interested in something like that. I'm sure Joe has already cleverly come up with a story that makes it work. I think I would put my money there. But I'll tell you what, story number two and story number three, that's a harder guess for me. Are we going on the line here? Are we really trying to guess?
Yeah,
go for it.
Yeah, I say why not? We take
okay. Here we go. So there's my first. There's the first guess. Is Sheridan? I don't mean it's going to be in this order, but he would be among the top three. Would be. I would think the. I would think Marcus. I would put my money on Marcus. Would be another story has yet to be told, and that Jason would be amenable to making it a business deal. And then, are we 100% confident that these three stories are with the original cast or are about the original characters?
I'm thinking cast.
Well, I given that one of the hang-ups with the Memory of Shadows feature film deal was disagreement with the studio as to recasting the characters, I think it's safe bet that if you're talking about characters, you're also talking cast as well.
Mm-hmm.
Well, not necessarily. Because you could do, look at Anakin. We've watched that guy change over and over and over, so it's easy to do a baby Sheridan or a Marcus when he was a little twit or a great big old guy,
So we can see on ABC Family Babylon Babies, right?
Oh, jeez.
There you go.
No.
There you go.
No.
A bunch of little coshlings is what I was thinking.
Oh, yes. Dear, he's outgrowing his encounter suit. We're going to have to go down to Target and get him a new one.
Let's see. Who would I want to say?
I don't know who the third one would be for me. I don't know who would... I don't know who would go for it.
Well, I'll say there's two different things here. I'm gonna qualify my second choice my first choice is a Sheridan story. My second choice is if he's incorporating the entire Babylon 5 universe, I'd want to see another Gideon story, or perhaps a Lockley story. My third choice is Veer.
Ooh, Veer's a good one.
Mm.
Yeah, I was going to go for the sort of the dark horse. I was going to toss out somebody like Corwin, or perhaps Number One.
Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Let me tell you something. Number One's
rocks.
A very good guess.
That's
a
rock.
Good guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a lot of reasons that would work. So yep,
yeah.
I would. That's a good one to put your money on.
Now going forward in the future, I read something. Scanning through all the Usenet posts and whatnot, where JMS had mentioned talking about stories about the guy who spearheaded the Babylon project, and that those stories got shelved because it wasn't working in with what he was trying to tell in the original Babylon 5. So I'm curious to know whether or not those stories show up down the road.
That's a good one. Actually show what led up to, like, between the war and the creation of the first station, what is that story?
Right. For that matter, you've got the war 1,000 years ago that you can talk about.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what I think is going to be one of the intriguing things about this project, should it be successful in sales with the first few DVDs, is that he does have the entire Babylon 5 universe and history to play with. I mean, there's a million years of history for him to start telling stories about. And given how well he managed to work in two separate episodes, if you will, with Babylon Squared and War Without End, and even though with one you knew how some events were playing out in Babylon Squared and how they ended up really being played out in War Without End, I don't have any fear that the great maker going back and writing quote-unquote prequels will be lame or have any less power than, because you know what happened in Babylon 5. I have a feeling he'll work it in such a way that you'll be on the edge of your seat.
Mm-hmm. And other interesting stories, every one of the stories that was told in Deconstruction of Falling Stars.
Right.
Oh, man, are you kidding
me?
I would love to see more detail about those areas, especially 500 years and 1,000 years in the future. Those stories, I loved those. Got the little, the very, very snarky AI Garibaldi going, I've been looking around.
I can tell you one thing. Here's a prediction. We're going to have to devote most of next week's episode to listener and viewer because there's going to be a lot of feedback on this topic.
You know what? And I'm fine with that. I really am.
I'm good with that, too.
Exactly.
I'm good with that, too. All right, so what's on the slate for tonight, kids?
Tonight, we will be talking about Babylon Squared. And in addition to the later, I guess, the listener feedback, we'd like to get your thoughts on working with Tim Choate.
Oh, okay. We can do that.
Sound like a plan?
I'm good with that.
Okay, in that case, we will take a short break and be right back with some episode geekery.
Grasshopper, you have learned much in your training. However, to achieve ultimate geekness, you must pass one final test. You must snatch this chip from my hand, Grasshopper. I wasn't looking. You must snatch this chip from my hand. Once again, you must snatch this chip from my hand. You must snatch this chip. Enough!
Learn from the true masters. Visit kickassmysticninjas.com.
And now into the fun part. Talking about episodes, dissecting them as best we can, and as only true Babylon 5 geeks can.
That's us. Tonight's episode, Babylon Squared. Babylon 4, the station obviously prior to Babylon 5, which had disappeared mysteriously 4 years earlier, reappears. And Sinclair and Garibaldi go to investigate. Summer, let me ask you a question.
Okay.
Because there's two ways to look at this. I'm sure you, like I, have watched this particular episode many, many, many times.
Mm-hmm.
And taken it apart and reassembled it and looked at it in context of other episodes. But your first initial impression when you first saw this episode, what was that?
The first impression I got was that, the very, very first impression I got when I saw it the very, very first time was how far in the future is this war being fought? Because by then I was starting to get, suspicious of certain storytelling techniques. Little twists that you don't see coming. So my mind would actually, okay, what's the twist I'm not seeing here? So actually at one point I figured that Babylon 4 was going to replace Babylon 5 because Babylon 5 had been destroyed.
Interesting.
That was my first impression because I was looking for the sneaky.
Gotcha. I will say that I wasn't looking for the sneaky. My first impression when I saw this episode for the first time was my eyes got big because I really felt like this was the first episode that broke open what you, or at least cracked the door to what the bigger story was going to be. I really got the sense that this episode was like getting dropped in the middle of something else going on.
Mm-hmm.
And much like Sinclair and Garibaldi, and for that matter, Major Krantz and everybody else on the station, they were just trying to hang on for the ride, and so was I. There were a lot of elements in it I thought that were kind of cheesy, but that's more a production end of things for a show that's already budget-strapped. But having said that, it was really like a whole new bunch of threads, and I was trying to put them together with what little I knew was going on from watching season one, and next to nothing jibed, and that was really, but like you, I knew there was something else going on here, so I knew this wasn't just an episode full of red herrings.
Mm-hmm.
You know, It all obviously meant something, and just trying to figure out what that was and how it all tied together was quite the ride, and it was thoroughly enjoyable.
Yeah, as it, having proof that there was time travel involvement, saying, okay, we're taking this because the future depends on it. kind of talk.
Right, you're like, except we're taking it to the past.
Yeah, which we didn't find out till what, 2 years later? We're taking it to the past to protect the future. And you're like, okay, right. my mind wasn't expecting a sharp left like that, but okay.
Right, Zathras mentions it at one point. You know, he says, Zathras, tell, great war, 1,000 years ago, need this place. And then you're going, what? but yeah, I mean, most everything that goes on in that episode is just slam bang, one thing after the other. One of the things that really impressed me in terms of, you were talking the time travel angle, this is the only time travel show, if you include this in a sense in a mini arc with War Without End, where we see Sheridan and Delenn and our heroes actually do beat of stealing Babylon 4. This is the only time that time travel shows up in Babylon 5, and it's not used as the big reset button.
Mm-hmm.
Like we see in so many other shows where time travel shows up and then keeps showing up. You know, it's not used as a device to try to break outside the constraints of the show format. It's an integral part of the story. And is only used as such for that one particular element. And that restraint, if you will, is just admirable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the it's one element of the story. It's an important element, but it only factors into that one thread. And that's a good thing.
Right.
Yeah. Because I don't know, it was like seeing, what was it, the one... I guess the reason why I thought it was Babylon 4 was going to replace Babylon 5 because it had been destroyed was Sinclair's vision.
Right. Right. And that was, you know, I liked the visions that were going, you know, past and future. I thought that was an interesting twist on things. I liked, we see Garibaldi's past when he's dealing with Lys.
Mm-hmm.
And Garibaldi's reaction to what's going on has to do with what he's trying to figure out. Where am I in time? And she's interpreting it as, you know, what's going on? Well, I'll tell you what's going on. You're leaving with a Sinclair character for Babylon 5, and you're turning your back on what we've built, and I'm not going with you. You know, so it was an interesting juxtaposition of dialogue, you know?
Yeah, that was good. I also, seeing Delenn's vision and seeing that payoff much, much, much later, almost exactly the way it was done before, I was like, whoa, that's cool.
Right, right. Now, the one of the things that I really liked in this episode is everyone's reaction to all the weirdness. Nobody came out of there as the stalwart hero, you know, even if they were bewildered, nobody was like going, yes, this is just some strange trick of what's going on, and I know where I really am. Krantz looks almost crazed.
Yeah.
You know, when they finally meet him, he's like going, I don't know what's going on, but there's this edge to him, you know, and it's not like he's crazy. I mean, you really get the sense if he is going crazy, it's because really, really crazy stuff is happening.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody has that reaction. You know, after Garibaldi has his vision, he pauses and Sinclair says, are you okay? It's like, let's get the hell out of here. You know, he's just, you know, when Sinclair has his vision, he's looking around like, what was that? And Krantz tells him, well, it's different for everybody.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we got to get out of here.
Yeah. I think at first when I realized how long they had been gone, I didn't know. I was curious, but I didn't let it. It didn't affect my impression of the episode. Like 4 years. Did they have 4 years worth of supplies on there? Have they been going through this thing, this time shifting for 4 years? And we find out in War Without End, no, they haven't. They've only been going through this for like a couple of days tops.
Right, or you know, even a matter of hours when all is said and done. Yeah, yeah. And what's really interesting that I think is a marvelous contrast to all the insanity and everybody starting to come unhinged as the station is moving through time in this impossible voyage is Zathras. He is cool and unflappable through the whole thing. The only time that he, I don't want to say spills the beans, But that moment when Sinclair walks in and he stands and goes, ha, oh, and then goes, no, not the one.
Yes.
Not the one. And, you know, watching it, that was one of the things when I first saw the episode, I'm thinking, obviously Sinclair is the one, because that's the kind of reaction someone who's not particularly bright will give.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's that kind of, you know, nope, I said, I was told not to say that you're this person I recognize, and so I'm telling you I don't recognize you. And it's like,
yeah
you do, but what? You know, and there's a great scene where Krantz is talking with Sinclair about how they're stuck in time in the station of the stable and they got to get out of there. And the whole time as Krantz is starting to get, you know, ramped up about this whole thing, Zathras is just sitting there nodding knowingly. Yeah, you know, he makes a couple hand gestures like, yep, you ought to listen to him. And it's just such a marvelous contrast to everything else that's going on. You know, this sort of hyper excitability of characters.
Yeah, and the scene, I don't know how he managed to do that through all that makeup. When Sinclair walks in the door, you see him look up, and there's this light of recognition and, oh my God, I'm saved. And, oh, no, you're the wrong one. Wait, no.
Nah, can't just, tell you. No, not the one.
That much emotion through the makeup was just beautiful.
Yeah, it's fabulous character acting by Tim Choate in that role.
How many lines are B5 geeks quoting that are Zathras' line?
Yeah. Now, I'll admit, a fair amount of them actually come from War Without End. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if it's fair or not to start talking a little bit about that episode. But, yeah, there's...
My favorite line from this episode has to be, "You are finite. This is finite. This is wrong tool."
That's War Without End.
Is it? Oh, that is.
Yeah, that is. It is. Talking to Ivanova. See, I took the liberty of watching the second part of War Without End to see how everything dovetails back in with what we see in Babylon Square. And it's remarkable.
Overlap.
You know, go on. Well, yeah. I mean, it's and how well they worked in the footage from Babylon Squared in with what goes on in War Without End.
Mm-hmm.
But we might be getting ahead of ourselves
a little bit. I will comment on one little thing that was in Babylon Squared that I didn't realize how important it was, and it was just such a minor thing. When we see the older Sinclair, and he says, "I tried to warn them." And you hear Delenn's voice saying, you know, "It's okay, let's go." You just see her hand. You don't see her.
Yeah.
That's a foreshadowing of her change.
Right.
And
the
fact that it was just so subtly done it literally didn't click in until after we saw her come out of the chrysalis. I was like, "Oh, that's why they did that. That's cool."
well, even beyond that, Sinclair's line, "I tried to warn them, but it happened just as I remembered it."
Mm-hmm.
And that ties in, of course, with all the Garibaldi watch your backs
that
you pointed out in year one. And in War Without End, Sinclair is outside the station trying to radio to contact Garibaldi.
He's like, watch your back, Michael, watch your back. Yeah.
Right, exactly. But watching that episode that first time, "I tried to warn them, but it happened just as I remembered it.
Yeah.
And watching it going... Again, that just amplified the feeling of being dropped into the middle of a greater story and knowing this all had meaning. And I think at that point, you know, like you were talking earlier about being familiar enough with what was going on with the show in the first year that you were looking for the sneaky twist.
Mm-hmm.
I think, speaking for me personally, that, for lack of a better term, had come to trust JMS with what he was doing, so that none of that really felt like it was just cheap writing for dramatic purposes to try to hook you in. If you follow me.
Yeah.
It really seemed like this was all part of a bigger plan, and hang on for the ride, but trust me, because you're going to get the rest of the ride later on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So what do you think about the time travel aspect of whether or not you're fated to do certain things or whether or not certain actions can change the future?
in terms of the Babylon 5 universe and what the show implied?
Yes.
Or
well,
me personally?
I guess we can go into that if we have time, but in what we see in the Babylon 5 universe.
Well, there's two ways to look at it. I think with the time travel story it's portrayed, and yes, we have to go to War Without End to talk about it. As Ivanova says, everything's happened like we knew it was going to happen, whether we wanted it to or not. So in that sense, even though we perceive time linearly, time is obviously not necessarily a linear quality. In other words, even though Babylon 4 has come 4 years into its future, we know that Sheridan and his expedition had to go 4 years in the past to grab Babylon 4, and they initially wanted to take it back the 1,000 years, but they're the ones that projected it 4 years forward,
mm-hmm.
to the point where Sinclair and Garibaldi come on board the station to help evacuate it and run into Zathras the first. So the events just unspool as they unspool. Now you've started getting into the whole nature of prophecy, because as we know, Sinclair becomes Valen,
mm-hmm.
and he rides Babylon 4 back in time to the Great War 1,000 years ago. And of course, his memories and what he knows of the future at that point is what he writes down and directly influences Minbari society, which brings us up to where we are. And to the B story, even if you want to get into that, where Delenn is given the news that she's been selected to become the new leader of the Grey Council.
Right. Hmm.
And, of course, she refuses that appointment because she feels like her heart is telling her that she needs to be on Babylon 5.
Right. She wants. And she believes in the prophecy so much she's turning down leadership.
Right. And that had never been done in the 1,000 years since Valen had established the Grey Council. So then at that point, do you say, is that something that Sinclair learned in his time in Minbar as Entel Zah? And so he writes it down as part of the prophecy?
I don't know.
Or not, because it's the kind of thing that when you're dealing with prophecy, some of it has to be based on faith.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and then how do you interpret the prophecies, knowing that it's just the memories of what happened to someone who traveled back 1,000 years? It's like
right.
It's like me going back last week to get the Powerball ticket numbers, the winning numbers.
Yeah, right.
You know, he's just writing down what he's writing his memoirs, but to everybody else around him, they haven't happened yet. So
right,
is he creating a line, the timeline that he remembers by dropping these prophecies in there?
Sure. I mean, yeah, I think, you know, in that sense, that's one of the beauties of this episode. I think the episode itself, there are instances where it's, you know, I don't want to say cheesy, although it's kind of there. You know, you've got the, I think it was a little bit of cheap action when Garibaldi and Sinclair come on board the station and they find themselves under fire.
Yeah.
Although that gets explained away, everybody's becoming unhinged because of all the weirdness that's going on. This guy just snapped. You know, okay, I can see that. But the fact is, I think that this episode is important as much for the kind of conversations it springboards us to, like we've just been having. You know, like I said, this story, it puts you in the middle of something bigger, and to discuss it, you have to start delving into issues of what does Sinclair / Valen know? What did he write down? And what did he leave out, for that matter? You know, so that when it comes to issues of prophecy, the issues, does Delenn refuse the great honor of becoming part of the Great Council? Prophecy, you know, there's not an instruction book that says you're going to do this, that, or the other. You know, at some point, it becomes vague. Now, whether that's a limitation of Sinclair's knowledge or not, or something on purpose, because that's part of what has to be done in terms of forging Delenn's character for the upcoming darkness.
Mm-hmm.
To face that, who knows? But it's just, it gets the mind thinking, you know. You have to start, once you start picking at one thread with this episode, you just have to keep following it to wherever it goes. You know, this episode, as much as any other, is so much not a standalone episode.
Yes. Speaking of, you know, Delenn, she receives the final piece of her puzzle.
Yes. Yes. And as the leader pro tem, if you will, tells Delenn, you know, I mean, she's shocked that he offers it to her. She's like, her eyes are wide. She goes, I can't. He goes, look, there's two others. This one won't be missed for a time. So that's okay. And if you're right, you're going to have more need of it than we are. And one of the things, as they get to talking, he tells her, there's a great change coming. I feel it in my bones. There are signs and portents everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's an ending or a beginning, I can't say. But as that scene is being shot, and we'll have to ask, you know, get Jeffrey to get one of the cinematographers or the lighting guys on, there's this grid-like shadowed projection. You know, obviously they're shooting a light down on the actors.
Mm-hmm.
Through some sort of a gobo or what have you. But the grid pattern looks just like a cage. And there's this visual metaphor, at least in my mind, of characters, I don't want to say trapped, but they are definitely finding themselves.
Their
choices being narrowed. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, they're being bound by the circumstances around them.
Right, exactly. And that visual element just really brought that home for me. You know, the Great Council, they can't do but what they've done, which is to nominate Delenn. And, you know, they're all in a turmoil. And as we see later on, her refusal to take that post opens up a spot on the Great Council because, well, whether a change that she undergoes, they kick her off the council and then they appoint another member of a warrior cast, which
mm-hmm.
imbalances the Great Council,
right,
set forth by Valen. So her refusal to be their leader sets in motion, you know, a chain of events that eventually leads to other things happening.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, they didn't actually kick her off until after her transformation, right?
Right.
Okay.
Right, but having said that,
her refusal was one step.
It had to cast doubt in their minds about her motives, because that's one of the elements you hear elsewhere, but certainly in this episode, is, you know, who, basically they're questioning, who is she to interpret prophecy?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's said again and again, you know, Delenn, your place is with us. Prophecy will tend to itself.
Right. And we see, we find out later that she is holding on to the prophecy. She believes in them very, very deeply because Dukat told her,
right,
these are going to happen. So
right,
she was like Dukat's chosen. So now she's following Dukat's wishes. Dukat believed that these prophecies were coming true. Impending
right,
darkness was on the way. She is actually, even though they say we're appointing you because you were the chosen of Dukat, by turning their backs on her when she's following Dukat's vision, that actually is a hint, a foreshadowing hint to the later rift in the whole Minbari culture.
Right. Exactly. And that just goes to show the whole depth of the world, obviously, that Straczynski envisioned. But with this one episode, again, with that supposed B story, you start picking at that thread and you just have to follow it all the way.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's interesting, you know, almost in a sense of a symmetry, the story of the battle on Four Station goes backward in time. Delenn's actions go forward in time, which of course end up with her being involved with Sheridan, where they go to steal the station and take it back in time. Yeah, right. right.
You could almost get dizzy talking about that.
Yeah, again, back to War Without End, as Ivanova says when she's confronted with all this, I'll wait in the car. One last question for you,
mm-hmm,
before we leave this topic. Do you button then zip, or do you zip and then button?
I believe I have always fastened then zip.
I will admit that after having watched this episode, I had to consciously be aware of what I was doing so I could answer that question.
And which is it?
Fasten then zip.
And zip.
You want to talk socks?
No. We're not having that conversation.
Oh, love that scene. That's just a lot of fun.
There's the mischievous imp that lives inside of Garibaldi must have loved that scene. Because you see him, he's all serious. And then all of a sudden, there's this slight, subtle change. And you see the glint in his eye from 100 miles away. Oh, what's he going to do now?
Yeah. Yeah.
I've always loved that character. And I love the way Jerry Doyle portrayed him. That was just always fun. Always fun to me. So that will conclude our discussion about Babylon Squared. And I'm sure we're going to get hundreds of comments on this one, which is good because talk is always good. We'll be back in just a sec.
Kickball, jump rope, tag, monkey bars.
For many of us, recess was an important part of the school day, and it offered so many options.
A chance to tell a joke, sing a song, and to be with our friends outside of the classroom.
But now, with academics emphasized and budget cuts looming, recess is on the firing line.
Believe it or not, approximately 40% of schools across the USA have either eliminated or are considering eliminating recess.
Many educators think kids return from recess more exhilarated, confident, and imaginative.
Experts agree that playtime can be just as vital as classroom time to a child's social, emotional, and educational development.
So if you think it's about more than a game of hopscotch, it's time to speak up.
For more information on Rescuing Recess, go to www.pta.org
or rescuingrecess.com. Because recess isn't just child's play.
And now for the listener feedback and general commentary segment of our show. Since Tim Choate portrayed one of our most favorite characters in the Babylon 5 universe who didn't get tons and tons of screen time and was unfortunately taken from us too soon. Jeff, can you talk with us a little bit about what it was like to work with Tim?
Well, I will say that you don't realize how much you miss somebody until you realize that you miss them, if that makes any sense. I guess it's just one of the things that you kind of put in the back of your mind, deep in the deep rest, just as because it hurts to miss him so much, and I do. I can tell you only of my own firsthand experiences that that very first time that Zathras walked on the set, that costume and that makeup seemed to be so over the top that it seemed like it was a mistake. It really, really did. I just, you know, as John Bulich had told us, you know, there were an awful lot of experimentations with alien characters. Mm-hmm. And when we saw Zathras walk out, I know my first impression or thought was just like, oh, man, this is a bad idea that's gone really bad, you know. And then when it came time for him to do the rehearsal and give his first lines, and we saw the character emerge, it was such a mind-bending reversal that, oh my God, this is sheer brilliance. This totally, totally, totally works. It was a wonder to watch him. you really didn't know what was coming out next. I had read the scripts. I knew the lines, but I never, ever, ever imagined that they were ever going to come out the way Tim would do them. They were fabulous. He was such an amazing talent. He was a very, very, very gentle man in every sense of the word. He was kind and caring and would be that way from the very get-go. The minute you were introduced to him or the minute you started a dialogue, you absolutely had Tim's full attention. He listened to every word you would say with deep, deep interest. And that, in my experience, never, ever wavered. I had the pleasure of being at Tim's house. Tim has been to our house, so our relationship was at least that close that we had, you know, personal interactions outside of the set. I did attend his funeral, and I have to just tell you point blank that it was Tim's funeral was so sad that it was not possible for me to stay through the entire event. It was he was loved by such a huge number of people in all walks of life that were gathered at the Egyptian Theater in downtown Hollywood, and it was that was tough. It was really hard. He was an exceptional human, and for our purposes. An exceptional alien as well.
Yes.
How much of what was in Zathras' character, Tim, and how much of it was what he picked up from what the director and what JMS was after?
I don't know that I'm completely qualified to answer that, but again, just in Jeffrey's opinion, it sure seemed like it was an awful lot of Tim. I mean, he I don't recall being ever in like a casting session with Tim when he was creating that character or anything like that, so I don't think I had any previous experience. You'd have to ask, you know, Joe or John Copeland or somebody else about that sort of stuff, but I can just tell you that it was just so amazingly him, and I don't recall ever seeing any, like, coaching about it. You know, maybe Joe and Tim had great in-depth talks about it. I'm not aware of that, though. And he was just so... And the thing is the Zathras character was not Tim. Not at all. That's maybe why he, you know, was able to do it, because it wasn't him. He was able to go, like, to this other side of his personality and draw on things that didn't really exist, and that's what made Zathras so kind of special. And he's...
Well, hopefully we can get someone on the show in the future who can give us a little bit more insight to the development of Zathras' personality as portrayed by Tim Choate.
Yeah.
Okay.
I remember Tim also telling us about how he did the character, and it's not fair for me to try to repeat how he created the character, but I remember that it was a very multi-leveled thing. You know, he had a headache, but a sore throat, but he also had this thing going on, and he thought of this character and that character, and he brought all these elements together, and that's what sort of gave him the Zathras character.
So he's a alien hypochondriac? I'm just guessing here. Okay, do we have any emails from our listeners to go through?
We've got quite a few emails from our listeners to go through. Let's start with the first three Babylon stations. This comes from Jeffrey's friend, Jim Carr.
Yay.
Who basically forwarded on a posting from JMS through the Usenet. He did find it. The date on this was from 26 May 1996. This comes from the great maker himself. The first three Babylon stations never got much past the very earliest stages of construction, just some hull elements, that sort of thing, nothing that could be recognized. Other forces took them out, mainly for political reasons. So I guess that might take the Vorlons off the hook, and also would explain why nobody seemed to have recognized on either side the first three Babylon stations. Maybe those are stories that will show up on the DVDs.
So, because Babylon 4 was the first one that got close to completion, nobody recognized any of them when the first three were being built.
Hmm. Correct.
I'll buy that.
Yeah. All right, next one we've got up. This comes from Scott Frisk. Hey, guys, love the podcast. I Googled Babylon 5 cookbook and got a lot of hits. Here's an article. He posts a link to a Wikipedia article on Spoo, which I read and is absolutely hilarious. I highly recommend going to find it. Anyways, Scott continues, about halfway down is a section on real-world Spoo, which gives some info on the cookbook along with a reference footnote with details on it. And the details are written by Emerson Briggs Wallace. The copyright date is June 1998. Dining on Babylon 5, Human Edition, the ultimate collection of space station cuisine.
Mm.
So somebody out there's got to have a copy.
I think I'm going to have to go searching for a copy now that I know the title of it.
Exactly.
I know there's one in my archive somewhere. You could go dig through that if you want. I'm sure you'd find all kinds of treasures in there.
I'm going to have to look at... That sounds
like an invitation to me.
And while you're in there, could you categorize everything, make a list for me, and put it on eBay?
Sure.
If that's what it takes, sure.
If I get first dibs on the really cool stuff, sure.
Okay, let's see. Next one, next email. This comes from Mike Tuck in Tennessee. I've just finished listening to your episode discussion of the two-part episode of Voice in the Wilderness, and I have some comments about your view of it. I realize that you are entitled to your opinions, but mine are slightly different. First of all, I thought it was unfair of you to grade the two episodes on the basis that The Great Machine did not get used to its fullest potential in later episodes. I know it's difficult to look at these episodes without seeing the greater scheme of things for the whole series, but I think that the episodes should be rated on a standalone basis. Given this viewpoint, I thought that these were the best episodes of the first season. Earlier season one episodes were hit and miss, and as we all know, the show really wasn't great on a regular basis until season three. These two episodes, first really good episodes, were the first really good episodes in the series and still rank among my favorite episodes in the entire series. I think the fact that The Great Machine was really not used to much effectiveness later on is not the failure of these two episodes, but the failure of those later episodes. In the story, I really enjoyed the fact that they went off the station to a planet we hadn't seen before and showed off some of the then-impressive CGI. I also really enjoyed the mystery aspect of the story and finding out what or who the holographic image was and what was happening on the planet. I thought that the action parts were also good, and the action parts of the series always made the show exciting and fun to watch. Thanks for taking the time to read this. I always enjoy the podcast, even when I don't agree with you on something. Keep up the good work. My sucks.
That's a bold statement.
Yeah. Well, as Mike says, you know, we're entitled to his opinions, and his are slightly different. But he's wrong; we're right. So.
Well, I will slightly disagree that saying "Voice in the Wilderness" is the best, the first of the best episodes, or the best episodes of season one, because I like Eyes, I really do. Even though we have a little issues with the fighting at the end, I love that episode. It just shows more political agendas. Deathwalker and Believers. I like Believers. I really do. That's a very powerful episode. So it's not, those two aren't the best of the first episode, but it's literally, for me, it's smack dab in the middle of the exponential improvement of the last, six, seven episodes of the first season. Every episode, I think, gets better and better and better, starting with Eyes.
I would agree with that on general principles. You know, my issues with those two episodes are on record from last week's podcast.
Mm-hmm.
And I would also argue Soul Hunter, for me, was one of the first great episodes, and that was early on in the run. Mm-hmm. But having said that, I also think that the show really actually was good on a regular basis at the beginning of season two when Boxleitner comes on board. So having said that, though, you know, I think Mike makes some interesting points, and
and
you know, hey, I like it when people disagree with us, because that means they're listening and it means they care, and it just shows that there's, you know, so many ways to look at this thing.
Yep.
all, everybody's welcome to disagree. They're all wrong, but they're welcome to disagree.
Right.
So speaks the Vorlon.
All right. I believe we have a couple voice messages to play now.
Yes, we do.
Hey, Tim and Summer. This is Alexis, formerly from Ohio, now from Florida. You aired my Voice Up on Podcast 13, which is freaking awesome. I've had a question kind of going through my mind. I've been going through some of the older podcasts, and I was listening to the one from Wayne Alexander and the one from Pat Coleman, fabulous, of course. And they were talking a little bit about royalties and, you know, kind of joking around about if they were going to be seeing any money from all these new venues that Babylon 5 is being passed through. You know, we have the AOL, now BitTorrent. And I was just wondering, can we find out, will we find out if and who is getting money from all of this, how the money is flowing? Because as a fan, you know, I want to support the cast and the crew and the writers and the creative team and all that other stuff, and I just kind of want to know if that's where the money is going or where the money is going, and if people aren't paying royalties, is there something we can do as fans to kind of put our voices out there and say, look, this money is being generated, where is it going? So that's just a question that's kind of been rattling around in my head, and I hope maybe we can find an answer. So thanks, the podcast is fabulous, and I will keep listening. Bye.
Well, for the answer to that, I think we need to turn to the Babylon Podcast financial advisor, Jeffrey Willer.
Wow. Okay, so Alexis, I love you, and I'm going to clone you and replace the entire viewing audience of all television shows with you and all your clones. Wow, there is no easy answer here. Let's see, maybe there's an old adage that says, you know, smell the money, follow the money, and Warner Brothers puts up most of the money, so, in fact, Warner Brothers puts up all of the money, so, you know, chances are that they're the ones that have made the most amount of money on it. Everybody that worked for the show had a job. Everybody had their own individual deals worked out. Some were prescribed, some were negotiable, but you know, when the job is over, the job is over, and that's really all there is to say about that. You know, the people that own the property are the ones who make the money. That's a general rule, and I don't think there is any huge exception in the case of Babylon 5.
Okay.
Well, there we are.
Was that diplomatic enough?
Yes, that was. That was. I'm very proud of you. I really am.
You could take it out on the umpires later on.
Yes. Okay, let's go to our second voicemail.
This is Jasto from the Netherlands. I'm recording this in response to episode 27. First off, which of Londo's three wives is the dancer? Well, none of them. In a later episode, I think it's The Very Long Night of Londo Mollari in season 5, he tells us his family forced him to divorce his first wife, the dancer. Secondly, why wasn't the Great Machine used more? First of all, as Summer says, it is a huge Deus Ex Machina risk. Secondly, the alliance with the Great Machine was primarily for the Shadow War. I think it's actually logical that we see little of it after that war ends. And finally, the Great Machine belongs to itself and to the future, as Dral tells us, and we don't know which part of the future it belongs to. Perhaps for the Great Machine, the Shadow War was only a small part of what it was meant to do centuries or millennia later. Finally, Summer asked whether you missed anything about the episode. Well, I would have at least liked to hear you mention the third principle of sentient life, the capacity for self-sacrifice. Londo, according to Len, is very familiar with self-sacrifice, which says something interesting about his motivations when his character, as we know, will grow darker. It also ties in with the movie in the beginning, where he says he did everything he did for Centauri Prime.
Some excellent points there, and yes, the capacity for self-sacrifice was something that we missed, because it plays a big part in not just Londo's character, but other people we see along throughout the series.
Well, I think what's interesting, though, is you're looking at different sides of the same coin, if you will. Dral interprets that as doing something great and noble, but I think he thinks of it as more of an absolute and doing something good with a capital G, whereas Londo would feel the same way. But as Jarstow points out, everything he did for Centauri Prime. It's unfortunate, though, that he made a wrong, seriously wrong choices, thinking he was doing good. And in the end, you know, as we know, he submits to the Drak Keeper as much to keep Centauri Prime from being utterly decimated by the Drak. So he was willing to sacrifice himself for a greater cause. It's just that, unfortunately, the greater cause had a taint of darkness upon it.
I take that a step further and say that Londo's choices for self-sacrifice involved his ego, because if Centauri Prime returned to greatness because of him, he would get all the accolades for leading them there. So it was what he considered sacrifice, but he had an agenda to the sacrifice. It wasn't out of purely noble causes, as Drawl had said.
Right.
Okay, guys, as your sound engineer, I just wanted to let you know that there was something really odd about that last voicemail that you guys picked up. I don't actually think that he was human. I think he's an alien that's tuning into the podcast. Just an observation. I could be wrong.
He's
or
Europe,
an AI,
right?
Of some kind, yeah.
Hmm. That was the guy from Europe?
Yes.
Yes.
And he sent the voicemail to us, the unconventional method?
Yes.
Correct.
Not only was he very articulate and well-studied, but if I'm not mistaken, I think he was flirting with Summer there.
Everybody's flirting with Summer.
Ah, the life.
Yes.
But yes, I had forgotten that Londo's first wife, he was forced to divorce because of his family.
Yes, I had forgotten that as well.
So thank you for that, Jarstow, for reminding us just how hard it is to keep all of this in one brain. There's way too much information, but we love rediscovering it every single week.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Anything more?
That's all I've got.
Jeffrey?
Yeah. The only thing I got to add here is I'm watching, you know, the first pitch is about to be thrown out here, and it's being thrown out by former wonderful supermodel Cheryl Teagues, and I got to tell you guys, she's wearing a little plaid schoolgirl skirt, very short, with a Dodger jersey on top.
Oh, stop. I'm on my way.
I'm having a moment right now.
I'm on my way. Save me a seat.
The crowd goes wild. It's good to be the Vorlon, guys. That's all I got to tell you.
Okay.
Good to be the Vorlon.
Well, on that note, we will call this show a wrap. The voicemail is 206-338-2259. That's 206-338-2259.
The year the great dog fed us all.
You can also send us email at babylonpodcast@gmail.com or leave comments on the forums and the website. And we will see you next time on the other side of the gate.
The preceding program is part of the Farpoint Media family of podcasts. To find out more about Farpoint Media and the many other podcasts available, visit www.farpointmedia.net. A world of audio wonder awaits you there.